The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
So with all the talk about dining outdoors and being outdoors and sitting outdoors and getting our act together outdoors, we know that a lot of businesses in this country are going to be working their derrieres off to make the world happen for them economically, financially, and in every other sense possible. So on the Late Late Show, in the coming weeks, we're going to look into this and see how small Irish businesses are innovating, because you've been just being doing all you've been doing is innovating, or as they say, pivoting, since this whole thing began. So if you are doing that, and if you were getting into the wood fire ovens, or if you've got parasols that we should hear about, or outdoor heaters, or whatever it might be, we'd like to hear from you on the Late Late program. So I'll give you the Late Late email address. If you might be a restaurant moving onto a street, you might be a cinema doing a drive-in, or a museum moving exhibits onto the patio, or God knows what, just drop a line to Late Late Extra, all one word, at rte.ie. Don't send anything into the radio, because they'll just, those guys, they can't stand the Late Late. I know what you're talking about. If you do, we'll pass it along. Late Late Extra at rte.ie. Now, most important, I guess, like Ciarán, I'm in Killian. Killian Shiel, good morning, Killian.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm really glad to talk to you, because I was watching you on your date and I thought there's a fella with a story to tell. So thank you for agreeing to talk to us this morning. I appreciate it.
Oh no, you're welcome. I'm really happy to do it.
Thank you. Can we get a bit of a rundown of who you are and where you're from in the country, and what age you are, and let's start there for starters.
Yeah, I'm from Castlebar originally, mm-hmm. and I moved to London for about 10 years, and then I've been living in Navan now for the past 2 years, and I'm just turned 32. Well, actually, not just. I'll be 33 in November.
Okay, you're 32 and a half.
32 and a half.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. Well, let's go back to your story, because I got the sense that all roads lead to London for you, Killian.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was... I moved to London when I was sort of 17 or 18, just after I finished the Leaving Cert here in Ireland.
Yeah.
To go to music university, which was, which was great.
Yeah, very exciting. What were you playing?
So I was a drummer. Like, I always remember always wanting to be a drummer. So that was always the plan. And I went to a really cool school called Drum Tech in West London, which is, you know, full of the best teachers and absolute dream come true.
And why drums, Killian?
Oh, I don't know.
Just why not?
Why not? Maybe just, you know, it's just something I always remember wanting to do. I must have seen a drummer, you know, before I can remember, and just been infatuated with it.
Okay. I've got drums on the brain because that film I was talking about earlier on, Sound of Metal, which you will, any drummer I've ever met, I must say it to Ray from the house band, you will love this film, by the way.
Yeah, I saw it.
Oh, you saw it? Sorry, what did you think of it?
I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And the way that, you know, they incorporated, like, him losing his hearing and, you know, into recovery as well. Like, it's just, it's amazing, you know, having to surrender to be in debt instead of chasing, like, quick fixes and stuff like that. Like, it really, I could really relate to it.
His story is bonkers because it's so like yours. He was an addict in recovery, a drummer. I don't think you lost your hearing, but wasn't it remarkable how they played with sound? It was, you know, as the viewer, you could suddenly become a listener.
Absolutely. I mean, I just thought it was an absolutely brilliant film. Yeah. So hopefully it does well there.
I have no doubt. Let's get back to London and Kylie Minogue and yourself.
Oh, yeah. So that was one of the first big jobs I got in London. It was Théo Cruz and Kylie Minogue music video. I'm not sure if you remember that one.
Fire,
it was called.
Yeah.
Like an amazing, experience. It really gave me the confidence to get myself out there and start doing loads of auditions. And, you know, I was just in, you know, I just started getting into loads of different kind of bands. Then after that, I was playing in, quite a lot of function bands and really cool, like, party bands and, you know, originals bands and, you know, playing for singer-songwriters and, you know, being hired to go into the studio as a session drummer. And, you know, it was just, it felt like the start of, you know, everything that I'd really wanted to do.
How did you get spotted by a modelling agency?
Oh, I was actually in Westfield Shopping Centre with my mother. and I think the Kardashians were visiting or something. And okay. So there was plenty of people around.
And what happened?
She just walked up to me and asked me if I ever thought about being a model. And to be honest with you, I didn't have the first clue about sort of modelling or fashion or anything. If my mother wasn't there, I don't think I would have went for it. She was like, you know, oh, no, these are, you know, it was Elise who are, you know, they're a big agency in London. And I'd never heard of them, but my mum had. And she was like, you're going to this, you know, so you're going to this office. So.
Okay, so now you're a drumming model.
Yeah, exactly.
At what point did that lifestyle start to become clouded by excess?
Well, my lifestyle was, if I'm being honest, was always clouded by excess. You know, even before London, I suppose I would have been, I would have been smoking lots of weed and stuff. But mm-hmm. certainly, I would have been noticing it when I was about 25, I'd say. You know. Whether it was, you know, playing gigs and all the free drink, or, you know, going out with my friends from the fashion industry to the clubs and more free drink and the after parties. And, you know, I was always more interested in, you know, it became to a point where the creative side of both jobs were, you know, sort of taking a back seat, and I was more interested in drinking and all that stuff. And then, I just really needed it, I suppose, to be social as well.
Mm. This expression about crossing a lot of lines, what does that mean?
I suppose crossing a lot of lines, I suppose drinking in the morning would be crossing a line and being okay with it, you know what I mean? Like, not feeling guilty anymore about it, you know, and just saying, like, this is who I am now, and then, you know...
Can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Because I think somebody says to me drinking in the morning, I think, okay, we could keep going. I actually would like you to tell me, what does that mean? In other words, physically take me to the press where you take the drink out. Tell me what time it is and tell me what's going through your mind as you reach for that drink.
Well, you're wanting the, you know, it could be 9 a.m., you know, before you go to work, you know what I mean? And you need to get rid of the anxiety or, mm-hmm. you know, get rid of the shakes or, you know, you just needed to face the day. And it's really sad, but it just becomes part of life in addiction.
What are you drinking at 9 a.m. at that stage?
Whatever's in the fridge, you know, or whatever's left over, or, you know, you might have to stop and you might have to get out of the house and go down to the shop.
And that's one of the lines that you might cross. What other lines are you talking about, Killian?
I suppose... just, you know, becoming okay with the chaos in your life. You know, yeah. I mean, you're crossing a line there. You know, your life is chaos, and you're sort of accepting it, or you think you're accepting it, but you're actually just avoiding it. You know, I, for a long time, I would say, you know, in London, I'd be like, yeah, you know, I'm borderline alcoholic, and, you know, all this stuff, and, you know, in you kind of like boasting about it to kind of brush it off. And, you know, thinking that, you know, here, I'm owning up to this, but I'm, you know, nowhere near owning up to it. I'm being really immature and, you know, not facing it at all.
Did you lie?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that just becomes part of life. You know what I mean? Lying about my drinking has been something I've been doing, you know, as long as I can remember, you know, as long as I've been drinking.
Did you cheat?
Oh, absolutely, as well. You know, like, you know, if I was lying, I was cheating. You know, if I didn't have money, and, you know, I could, you know, manipulate, you know, my parents and my friends to help me out, and, you know, lie so I could get what I wanted or what I thought I needed.
Did you steal?
Yeah, there's been times where I've stolen drinks from the supermarket, or, you know. Mm. In desperate times now, but yeah. I'm ashamed to say it, but yeah.
Did you at any point look around you and realise that one by one the people who had been there enjoying the crack with you started to disappear, like that photograph in Back to the Future?
Yes, that's very well put. There was a time when I was in London and I was living with my older brother and his friend and a load of my friends from university who were also session musicians. And we had the best crack. We had the best life. It was a big house. We were all best friends. And, you know, I felt like, you know, I was hard done by when they all left and moved out and all that, and I blamed them for a long time. But, you know, it was the progression. And, you know, the next 5 years at the end of it, I was, you know, alone in a bed sit in Camden by myself. And, you know, there was very little real friends around me. There was acquaintances, a lot of acquaintances that I used to drink with, but the real friends had enough, I suppose.
And it was the two girls in Camden you were living with I think you started to have seizures, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. That was towards the end of my drinking. Things got, you know, things were really bad.
Yeah.
And I had a seizure, and they had to find my my parents on Facebook. Like, you know, they didn't really know me that well, to be honest. I still talk to one of them, and the lovely girls. Like, so yeah. They had to contact my parents, and my dad came over, and you know, he decided that was it, and he brought me back to Ireland.
And did you go into treatment at that point?
I didn't. I came back and I sort of hung around Castlebar for a while and got into a few scrapes, you know, as I was doing in London, except in a smaller town now where, you know, it becomes a lot more obvious to everyone around you. There was no kind of hiding from it then. And then I eventually went in for an assessment into Hope House with my dad. He brought me in there, and I stayed there for a month.
It was
my first taste of recovery, or the other side of life, I suppose, is what someone said to me once as well.
Is a month the right time? I don't know. Or was that a small amount of time, or was it enough?
It's a small amount of time for it depends on the person, I suppose. For me, it wasn't enough. I went on for about 7 months, you know. I stayed sober, but I suppose I was sort of a dry drunk, and so I wasn't really changing, you know, enough in my life, you know, to move on. You know, I was just kind of staying sober and not really tackling any other of the issues. So I ended up relapsing after 7 months sober. But what I realized, I suppose, when I relapsed was, you know, I couldn't drink ever again the same way as I did before I admitted I was an alcoholic. So, you know, I sort of wasn't welcome with the drinkers, and I wasn't welcome with the people in recovery. I was sort of very much on my own then. So it definitely got much worse when I relapsed after the clean time, you know.
You keep running out of road.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it.
When I go into the chemist and on the rare occasion I say, can I have a packet of Nurofen Plus or whatever it might be, they always say to me, are you taking anything else? You have to be careful. You know, and I kind of say, yeah. And that's the end of that. But it now makes sense to me why they're so curious or keen to keep an eye on it, because there are people out there who see Nurofen differently to the way I might see it. And you're one of them. You were one of them.
I was one of them, absolutely. So when I was back drinking and using after I relapsed, you know, I was still lying to quite a few people about being sober, you know, my family being the main ones. So I became addicted to Nurofen Plus, and because I thought it was easier to hide, and, you know, it sort of has similar effects to being drunk. So I would be taking, I started off taking, you know, a packet a day, but I mean, it quickly progressed, just like, you know, alcohol or any other drugs, until I was, you know, towards the end there, my whole life was traveling around to chemists in Mayo, you know, and knocking these tablets back 12 at a time, you know, on an empty stomach to get the effects off them. The consequences are just, they're so dangerous, you know.
At your worst, how many Nurofen were you taking in a day?
Two packs of 24 would probably be the height of it, and yeah, Sometimes a little bit more. But you know, I had a seizure because of them as well, and you know, it's not to forget the poor pharmacists as well, you know, who are giving these things out. You know what I mean? Like that's a consequence people don't really think about. It's something I feel bad about anyway.
Okay. All this time, was your dad kind of covering for you? Was he keeping an eye on you? Were you wrecking his head?
I think it's safe to say I was wrecking everyone's head. But you know, he was keeping a close eye on me. But he wouldn't have been. I mean, yeah, look, I'd do something. Something would happen because of my drinking or because of my using. And yeah, he'd give out to me and he'd be mad at me and he'd be disappointed in me. But you know, I suppose everyone would. But he knew that there was nothing he could do or not do that would make me drink or not drink. You know, he had an understanding of that. And so he was always like, you know, try again, go again, and you know, just don't give up. You know, and so was everyone, to be fair. But I think it's harder for some people to get their head around, you know, why are you doing this to yourselves? You know what I mean? It's hard to understand.
Let's get you back into treatment then for the second time. And this brings us to Navan. Is it Tabor House?
Yeah, Tabor House, yeah.
And you were there. How did that go?
So, yeah, I went into Tabor House, which is a secondary treatment centre. And, I stayed there for a month and... Unfortunately, my dad passed away while I was in there.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, that's desperate. Because he came to see you on Easter Sunday, is that right?
That's right. He came to see me on Easter Sunday and, we had dinner in Navan. And the next day, it was Easter Monday, I think we were up in Carlingford climbing a mountain. And, I got the phone call to say he passed away, which I just couldn't accept. I mean, it was such a shock, you know, because he'd just been with me the day before. And
how old was he?
60 years old.
That's desperately young.
And that was two years ago today.
This very day?
Yeah.
Man, oh man. Gosh, what do you think he'd make of you today in the sense that you are so honest? You are so honest and you're just such a... You're like a mirror image of the pathetic creature you described only a little while ago, no family, no friends. Would you say your dad's death... did something to try and make you flip this story?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to do this for him while he was alive. You know, it was always for everybody in my family. But you know, the shock of losing him and knowing that I'd never get to show him like that I could do it. You know what I mean? It just made me so determined to do it. Because I do. You know, there's a part of him that's in me, and you know. That's what keeps me going, and it's sometimes it doesn't even feel like any effort at all because I know this. You know, he's with me, and I know what he wanted for me, and I have faith that if I do the right thing, all the things he told me that would happen.
You had one last blowout, didn't you?
I went home.
After he died,
I was in a bad way for about 3 weeks, and just you know. Couldn't handle it, and you know, he definitely hit a rock bottom then, you know. They took me back in Tabor House, which was absolutely brilliant. I mean, they really didn't have to, and I'm pretty sure they broke a lot of rules to let me back in the condition I was in, but they could see that it was the last chance for me.
What it's got to be that they can only do so much, I presume. You have to do something yourself in terms of a realization, a catharsis of sorts. What was yours? What did you, when did you have it? Did you have a light bulb or a trigger moment where you said, "Nah, this has to stop now"?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll be honest with you. The treatment center is 4 or 5 months. You know, for a reason. They usually get through to someone after a couple of months or 3 months or so, and then the last month or two is for the, you know, it's for them to take everything in. Mm-hmm. But I think when I went back in, you know, the second time. After losing my dad and after hitting that rock bottom, you know, and with the horrendous relapse, I think I had a light bulb moment very early on because I was broken and I was ready to listen. I was ready to, you know, thank God. Like, I mean, sometimes I just feel like it was him doing it for me, my dad, like, because I stayed there. I listened to the suggested things. And I mean, you know, I was able to put myself well aside and listen to the professionals and do all the suggested things that they said to do. And I moved to Navan. I cut off, you know, pretty much everybody apart from my family. Not because they're bad people or anything, just because I needed the time, you know, to myself to heal and to grieve and to get over this addiction and to realize that, you know, there's another side to life and, you know, start experiencing it. And the first year was, it was really difficult. You know, I got a job really quickly, and that's something I suppose I always thought I was a hard worker, but it was very clear that I'd never had a job in my life when I started that. So I was so lucky here in Navan, and I've learned so much in the last 2 years. I'm still learning.
And your mother?
Yes.
How's your mother?
My mum is great.
Is she?
She is.
You have a good relationship with her?
We have a great relationship. Good. Now, I haven't seen her in... I haven't seen her in a while. I haven't been back home to Mayo since Christmas, so I really miss her, and I'm looking forward to getting back. Hopefully, I'm 2 years sober in the 15th of May, so I'm hoping that I'll be able to get back.
You're really brilliant, Killian. That sounds patronising, but I you know, because we talk to so many people here who don't, whose families are ruined and torn asunder by people who were like you but couldn't get through where you got through. So I hope you stay as strong as you sound to me today. I know that I saw you on First Dates, which is why you're here today. That date didn't work out, even though she seemed very lovely and you seemed like you got on very well. Did you meet anyone at all since, or can I ask?
Yeah, I actually have started seeing someone in the last few weeks, so, but it's pretty new, so okay. We'll see how it goes.
Let's not hex it by getting it go any further than that. there's lovely messages coming in. Anne O'Malley was on to say, I'm just listening to your chat this morning with Killian, a fantastic young man to have overcome so much. So impressed to hear him on your show and see him on First Dates. I know him and his family well. I've witnessed him at his worst after being such a lovely young fella, and I'm so proud of him now and so happy for his mother, Siobhan, to have the huge worry off her shoulders. Keep it up, Killian. You're an inspiration. That's from somebody listening in. Another says, I'm in tears listening. I lost my marriage. I nearly lost my kids. I put my wife and partner through hell. 2 trips to rehab and a lot more that happened. It's still happening. I lost friends in rehab from still drinking. I find it very hard at times. People are suffering. And so lovely to listen to Killian again. I was taken with him on First Dates and wish the date had gone well. He's a gentleman and an inspiration to so many young people struggling with addiction. I'm from a family deeply affected by alcohol for many years and can relate to so much of his story. He deserves every bit of happiness now. So let's leave it at that. Killian, thank you so much for your time. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, and I hope I meet you in reality at some point in the future.
No, I'd like that as well. Right?
Same here. Okay, stay strong and best to the family.
Okay, thank you,
Ryan. Thanks a lot. Killian Shield joining us. Bye for now. Joining us on the phone this morning. And it's just, it's a great story. Struggle, survival, and hopefully now and forever thriving. Thank you to him for that.